Today is Thursday, May 24th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, reporters probe President Trump on whether a meeting with North Korea will actually happen.
Someday a date will absolutely happen. It could very well be June 12th. We'll see. We'll know next week.
Saudi activists are targeted as a driving ban nears an end. International agencies are working to stop the spread of Ebola in the DRC. And also ahead, the royal love affair with Africa. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, North Korea says it will reconsider a summit with President Donald Trump if the U.S. continues with what it calls evil acts. Pyongyang is reacting to comments by Vice President Mike Pence, who appeared on Fox News Monday to warn leader Kim Jong-un that he'd be making a great mistake to play around with the United States before the talks. Trump said Wednesday the U.S. will know by next week whether he'll meet with Kim on June 12th in Singapore as scheduled.
We're going to see what happens on Singapore. We're going to see. And it could happen, could very well happen. But whatever it is, we will know next week about Singapore. And if we go, I think it'll be a great thing for North Korea.
Well, the North last week warned it may call off the summit because of U.S. demands it unilaterally give up its nuclear weapons. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo told the House Foreign Affairs Committee Wednesday he's very hopeful there will be talks, but said whether they happen is ultimately up to Chairman Kim.
Our posture will not change until we see credible steps taken towards the complete, verifiable, and irreversible denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula.
Pompeo said the U.S. won't hesitate to walk away from the talks if a bad deal is on the table. But visiting Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi, speaking through an interpreter, told reporters at the State Department that Beijing believes the summit should take place as scheduled.
Direct and contact and dialogue between the leaders is key to addressing the nuclear issue on the Korean Peninsula. We look forward to seeing the meeting take place as scheduled and be successful. We believe that President Trump and Chairman Kim Jong-un are fully able and they have the wisdom to make the right decision.
North Korea's Vice Foreign Minister Cha Soo-yeon said his country doesn't need a summit with Trump and won't beg for it. Meanwhile, the UN Security Council on Wednesday did lift a travel ban so a North Korean delegation can travel to Singapore next month. In Russia, the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum is getting underway with many world leaders in attendance. French President Emmanuel Macron is seeking closer ties with Russian President Vladimir Putin as the two men plan to meet to discuss a range of issues. Joining us for a preview is Paris-based journalist Catherine Field. Catherine, it's interesting to hear that these two very different leaders will actually get together for talks.
The strange thing is that in March, when we first had these allegations that Russia was behind a suspected nerve gas attack on a former Russian agent in the United Kingdom, there had been calls for President Macron to, if not cancel this visit, but to play down this visit, not be so visible in his meetings with Russian officials. But then, of course, since then, we've had the U.S. pull out of the Iran nuclear deal. So this is really up the ante. Now, President Macron of France is going to St. Petersburg, and really part of that effort now is to, if you like, tie President Putin into keeping the Iran nuclear deal alive. Let's remember, just last week, the German Chancellor Angela Merkel held talks also with President Putin, Russia. So this can really be seen as a way, if you like, of trying to get some sort of dialogue going, trying to, if you like, in a strange sort of way, reassure the Iranians that, strange though these alliances may be nowadays, they're trying to reassure the Iranians that there are not just Europeans that want this Iran nuclear deal to stay in place.
Is there any indication how Mr. Putin sees the agreement with Iran?
There's not really that much hope that there will be anything publicly. There are, of course, two other issues on the table, which is Syria for one and Ukraine for another. Now, there's very little chance that the French president will have any success on Ukraine. President Putin has said time and again that eastern Ukraine is not negotiable, and certainly not negotiable is Crimea. We've seen transport links between between Russia and Crimea being built, being opened quite recently, so there's no room for negotiation there. When it comes to Syria, however, there is the possibility of a wee bit of movement. There are these concerns that you could have Israeli and Iranian proxies fighting it out in Syria, and no one wants that. And also, President Macron will be looking for some sort of pulling back from the Russian side about their wholehearted support for the Syrian leader, Bashar al-Assad. That's, I think, the only possible diplomatic test we're going to see. But there, of course, you can't forget that there are these big economic ties. France is the largest investor in Russia. I mean, 2014, France has really been reinvesting in Russia. You know, once the EU sanctions, the course of Ukraine had died down a bit, France was back in there, its businesses were back in there. So it does want, if you like, to push the economic side of it. And that's another reason why the French president is going specifically during the St. Petersburg Economic Forum. He wants economic ties, he wants economic relationships. And at the end of the day, Emmanuel Macron has said that foreign policy means communicating, it means keeping dialogue, and that he wants to keep those channels of communication open, even though Macron has also said that he intends to talk about issues that will be delicate, such as in Russia, gay rights, election meddling. But apparently we hear from the Russian side that Russian President Vladimir Putin quite likes straight talk from the French president.
All right. Well, we appreciate your giving us some insight. That's Paris-based journalist Catherine Field. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The U.S. excludes China from military drill over South Korea or South China Sea actions. President Trump wants aid cut to nations not helping the U.S. stem illegal immigration. A judge rules Trump cannot block critics on Twitter. And Ukraine denies paying a Trump lawyer for White House meeting. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, there are nearly 30 confirmed fatalities from Ebola in Democratic Republic of Congo and nearly 60 confirmed or suspected cases. Congo's health ministry Wednesday announced 6 new suspected cases. The virus can be fatal in up to 90% of cases. Health experts agree the next few weeks will be crucial in determining whether the outbreak can be contained and prevented from spreading to highly populated urban areas. Authorities in Kinshasa started screening passengers crossing the border into Republic of Congo and back in an effort to stop the spread of the deadly virus. International aid agencies are also stepping up their response, hand in hand with authorities in the DRC. And joining us now for one such agency, or from one such agency, is Shiran Lavera, head of the emergency operations for the International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies. Thank you so much for being with us. It appears the outbreak is getting worse.
Yes, the cases are increasing, especially in the rural areas. We've increased our staffing into some of the preventive activities. This is where we really feel like we can get ahead of the outbreak, is in some of the prevention work. So our focus is really shifting more towards this at the moment.
What are you doing as far as that goes? I understand there may be some vaccinations happening.
Yes, there are vaccinations. Unfortunately, the Red Cross is not involved in the vaccinations. Our role in the prevention work is to spread the messages to the local communities around how to prevent Ebola and what to do if they suspect if they have any symptoms. All the Red Cross workers are local volunteers, which means they come from the affected community. We believe that they are the best place to deliver the messages because they're a trusted source in the community. They speak the local language, they know the local customs, they know who to speak to, etc. So this is the work of the volunteers that are doing right now, and we have more than 150 volunteers at this moment doing this work.
What exactly do you suggest to the communities as far as trying to prevent this from spreading?
What we try to tell them is that, first of all, we tell them that Ebola is a very deadly disease and how it's transmitted. So we educate people about how Ebola is transmitted through bodily fluids more frequently, and we tell them that they should not come into contact. If they come into contact with someone that has the symptoms of Ebola, that they should go to a health facility immediately. Some of the main symptoms, we tell them what they are, such as high fever, for example, and we tell them to basically go to the hospital immediately. And this is where the Red Cross is doing its second set of activities, which is called contact tracing. This is a lot of detective and investigation work. There's more than 700 contacts right now related to Ebola. That means every suspected case that individual has to be talked to and basically investigated who else did that person come into contact with over the last few days. And then the Red Cross volunteers goes around in communities, tries to find those people and make sure they're not showing any signs, symptoms of Ebola.
We know this is a very, very contagious disease. Beyond trying to spread the word of people not spreading it and doing what they can to prevent getting it to begin with, are you all involved at all with treatment of those that already have contracted it?
Yes, this is the work that's happening through the Ministry of Health and other organizations such as Doctors Without Borders and WHO. The Red Cross's role in these areas is these health facilities, whether they're hospitals or small health posts or clinics, is what we call infection prevention and control. This is probably a very important activity for the Red Cross to do. We're able to disinfect health facilities, for example, work with them to make sure that the right protocols are in place, make sure that the doctors and nurses are following the right procedures. This is also another way to stop the spread of Ebola as people come into the hospital. We want to make sure hospitals are safe places, they're clean spaces, and that Ebola can't spread further from there.
How long do you expect to be there?
It is a very serious operation, and unfortunately it is growing for us. So we're adding more and more people to this operation. We have more than a dozen expatriates right now in the operation, including more than 150 volunteers. And of course, we have to remember the local Red Cross here. The Congolese Red Cross is the main actor for the Ministry of Health. They're the ones that on a day-to-day basis work on this. We do anticipate this will go on for several months. We know that there's usually a period after the last case of Ebola, as we saw in West Africa. So we're here for the long term, certainly, and the Red Cross will always be here. They'll always be in the community, even after the Ebola operation stops.
Given where you are right now, are there logistical challenges that you're facing in trying to just do your work?
You know, this is a very rural part of Congo, away from the main urban areas of Bandaka. When we go into the rural areas, we have to travel by helicopter or motorcycle. Roads are almost non-existent, and it's also the rainy season, so it's very muddy on the best of days. So this makes it much more challenging for us to get around and find people. What makes it easier, in fact, is that most of the Red Cross personnel live in the communities already, so they're able to get around, and we don't need to bring in any additional resources. But logistically, it has been a challenge getting the operation off the ground.
All right. Well, we appreciate your bringing the information to us. That's Shiron Lavera, head of emergency operations for the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies. At least 10 women's rights activists have been detained in Saudi Arabia for what Riyadh calls suspicious contacts with foreign entities, providing financial support to enemies of the kingdom and attempting to undermine Saudi security and stability. The arrests come ahead of next month's planned end of a decades-long ban on women driving vehicles. Amnesty International denouncing the arrest, saying Prince Mohammed bin Salman's promises of reform fall flat amid the intensifying crackdown on dissenting voices. U.S. State Department spokeswoman Heather Nauert also expressing concern.
We remain supportive of their overall reform agenda. I think that's an important step in the right direction. A lot of people here and around the world were pleased and very happy to have heard their decision about women being able to drive on their own, attending movie theaters and things of the sort. I can tell you that we're watching this carefully. We are concerned about the announced detention of activists in Saudi Arabia. We support space for civil society and also free speech. But overall, we're concerned about it and we are keeping a close eye on it.
Among those detained are individuals who've long advocated for women's rights, including the end of the country's male guardianship system, giving men the final say over major decisions. Analysts and activists say the arrests send an unmistakable message. Future reforms will come only from the Saudi throne. Middle East Institute scholar Zubair Iqbal spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty about the detentions.
Clearly, there was some move towards liberalization and rearrangement of the coalition, the governing coalition, with younger people and women being brought in to replace the religious community as well as some older people in the generation. This particular move was not as successful as it had been assumed that it would be. Those particular forces, and I would say pressure groups, tended to react. And they finally got into a position where they could force the Crown Prince and the King himself to reverse some of their verbal propositions towards reform. When it comes to women's right to drive, this is considered what you could call a litmus test. It really isn't the fundamental issue. It's more like a litmus test as determining whether, if this happens, this would mean that a liberalization is now on the way. My personal feeling is, knowing the society as it is in Saudi Arabia, you can't do that. You either bring everybody along or you do not set out litmus tests to determine what the people will take or not take. The second one, which is, I think is also very important, is that the reformists or the liberal younger group, including women, felt that they have achieved a great victory and that now is the time for them to strike out for more.
Does this indicate a limit to Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's influence in the society?
The Crown Prince is relatively young and quite inexperienced. Yes, he's been given a lot of power. Yes, he seems to have some sort of a vision. However, the power itself is still in the hands of the court. And the real power is in the hands of the king and the court that supports him.
What will the end of the decades-old ban on women driving cars mean for society in Saudi?
Women were actually offered to drive, and they refused to accept it. The reason was, vast majority of them were quite comfortable having somebody else drive them. And this would have been an additional burden. It's only now that those young women who were in the college at that time, the university at that time, have now come of age, basically, and are now in a position to demand their rights, that it has become more prominent and significant.
All right, that's Zubair Iqbal. He said the message from Saudi authorities following the arrest is clear. Know how far you can go and no more. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hello, peepas. This is Heather Maxwell. Coming up on Music Time in Africa, I've got amazing music for you. From Cameroon, Mali, Zambia, Reunion, Nigeria, and Zimbabwe, Ghana's vote on most popular song of the year for 2017, hint, hint, Zongo. And a fabulous interview and live music session with Kenyan guitar masters John Nzeze and Peter Akwabi.
Angelique means it is Angelina. But Angelina, I just twisted the name to call it Angelique.
Join me this Friday and Saturday at 1505 and 20500 UTC. Music time in Africa. Yeah, babies.
VOA's International Edition continues as the traditional summer season in the United States approaches and Americans plan trips to the nation's beaches. The Trump administration is expected to announce its final plan to expand offshore oil drilling. A new study released Wednesday by a group of environmental organizations warns that coastal national parks face a threat from that expansion. Joining us now to talk more about it is co-author of the report, Nick Lund, senior manager for landscape conservation with the National Parks Conservation Association. Thank you for being with us, Nick. I understand this is a first of its kind. What's it all about?
We joined with the Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC, on this report highlighting the threat to national parks from a recent proposal from the Trump administration to open up vast new areas of our coastal waters to oil drilling. So in January 2018, Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke proposed a new plan for leasing in federal offshore waters. It was a radical departure from longstanding policy, and Zinke's plan opens up about 90% of all coastal waters, including areas in the Pacific Atlantic that had never been considered for leasing or drilling, to potential drilling.
So what did the report find?
The report found that there are about 68 national parks on our nation's coast that could potentially be impacted by an oil spill or other accident from new offshore drilling off their coasts. National parks are just a part of the puzzle here. There are also state parks, local parks, national wildlife refuges, and other beloved areas along our coast. We're focused on national parks and the impacts they have because they are not only protect beautiful environmental resources, but are huge draws for families and people going on vacation. So what we found is that these 68 national parks were visited more than 84 million times in 2017. Together, they contributed more than $5.7 billion in economic output and supported more than 59,000 jobs.
And the impact, you're talking about 18 states in particular in the report. You mentioned the concerns over oil spills. Is there any statistical evidence that you are using in the report to make your case?
We know because it's happened before. I mean, three of the biggest spills in American history all impacted national parks. So in 1969, there was a blowout on an oil rig off the coast of Southern California near Santa Barbara. It eventually leaked more than 4.2 million gallons of oil over the next year and impacted Channel Islands National Park, a beautiful park off the coast of Los Angeles out there. Many of us remember March 1989 when the Exxon Valdez tanker ran aground in Alaska. That ended up spilling 11 million gallons of oil along that coastline, including parks like Kenai Fjords, Katmai National Park, and Eniacchak. And then, of course, in 2010, there was a Deepwater Horizon spill, which spilled more than 171 million gallons into the Gulf of Mexico, including onto the sands of Gulf Islands National Seashore. So we know from our history that where there is oil drilling, national parks can be impacted. And those are just major spills. Of course, there's other smaller spills from tankers and containment vessels and pipelines that could also impact our parks that are part of expanded offshore drilling that we don't want to see.
What do you hope to accomplish beyond releasing the information from your report?
We need to tell the Trump administration that this is wildly unpopular. Their plan has been met with massive opposition, bipartisan opposition, local opposition on both the Atlantic and Pacific and Alaskan coasts. We want them not to pass this plan.
Have you had any response from the Trump administration?
We hope to get a response. They're working on, they submitted this plan over the winter. Comments closed in January on the draft plan, and we're waiting for them to release an updated, potentially final plan in the fall. We're still trying to make sure this is on people's radars as they plan their summer vacations, especially to coastal national parks, to remind them of the places they love and the fact that they're at risk. And so we hope that the administration will heed their calls, heed our calls, and take these areas out of the plan for oil drilling.
What would you say if the Trump administration came back and said, well, the money we can gain from offshore drilling, we can put back into the parks?
Yeah, we'd say it's not worth the risk. You know, one spill offshore can cost billions of dollars for a national park and other local economies. There are other ways to raise the money needed to protect our national parks and to, make sure that they're taken care of the best they can. But we don't need to risk our national parks and all of our other coastal resources to do it.
That's Nick Lund, Senior Manager for Landscape Conservation with the National Parks Conservation Association. Well, newly married Prince Harry has had a long love affair with the African continent. He spent his post-graduation year in Lesotho, vacationed with his bride-to-be in Botswana, and is rumored to be heading to Namibia for his honeymoon. His closely watched wedding to actress Meghan Markle, a mixed-race woman who's now the Duchess of Sussex, has also been hailed as a celebration of Black excellence. From Johannesburg, VOA's Anita Powell looks at what's next for the prince, his new wife, and for Africa.
The African continent has a special place in Prince Harry's heart. He's made numerous visits and done charity work here. He set up a children's charity in Lesotho, whose crown prince was the only non-English royal invited to the wedding. And so, as the couple said their vows at Windsor Castle, millions of royal admirers across Africa watched in rapture. Among them, Lesotho's former foreign minister, Mampono Kaketla. Kaketla met the prince some 4 years ago when Harry visited Lesotho.
He was a very charming young boy. He was at that point, so he's not very tied up, you know, very humble and down to earth he was.
Harry's new wife has shown her own fondness for Africa, remarking during a 2016 trip to Rwanda that, "My life shifts from refugee camps to red carpets. I choose them both, because these worlds can, in fact, coexist." Kaketla says she hopes the prince and his wife will continue their charitable activities. In Lesotho, she says, it has made a big difference.
It has actually helped us to put Lesotho on the map, on the world's map, if you have somebody of that stature coming to your country and doing what he has done. It has helped to destigmatize HIV and AIDS, you know, because and you can see some of the children that he started working with are now young adults.
But it's not only their charity that has captivated viewers in Africa. Lungile Zakwe is executive director of Ikamva Youth, a non-governmental organization that works with young and disadvantaged South Africans. She has become a regular guest on South African radio shows because of something a little more personal. Her Prince Charming is white. Until 1985, it was illegal for mixed-race couples to marry in South Africa. Zakwe says she applauds the royal family for normalizing interracial relationships.
People just try to understand how can two people from such different worlds come together and accept each other. And usually what comes up, and I'm sure it comes up for Meghan herself, is that how can you be pro-black and yet spend your life with somebody from another racial group? And for me, I find that it always makes me uncomfortable. I find it problematic because, of course, you can be pro-black and still be in love with somebody from another racial group.
Hairstylist Lisa May Hangeman said she felt the ceremony was the most inclusive royal wedding she has ever seen. The Duchess honored several African nations in the Commonwealth, including South Africa, by having their flowers embroidered into her 5-meter veil.
I loved the whole African theme that went with it. Maybe not so much the pastor. I think he went a little bit overboard, but definitely the choir that sang. I just thought it brought a little bit of diversity to it.
Zakwe says she was thrilled at the optics of the wedding. But she says something else shone even brighter than the talented choir, the pomp, the diamonds, and the fabulous guest list. What shone through, she said, is a powerful force, and one that transcends race, language, and borders. Love. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to director Tracy Carter, engineer Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has made clear that new and severe economic sanctions will be imposed on the Iranian regime until it makes a fundamental strategic decision to end its support for terrorism, its aggression in the Middle East, its proliferation of ballistic missiles, its pursuit of nuclear weapons capability, and other malign behaviors. But in outlining the United States' new strategy for Iran after the U.S. withdrawal from the nuclear deal, Secretary Pompeo drew a sharp distinction between the regime and the Iranian people. He deplored the fact that flush with cash and economic relief from the deal, the regime for 3 years did nothing to relieve the economic hardships of ordinary Iranians. Instead, it spent vast sums to fuel its march of destruction across the region. Secretary Pompeo promised that the United States will be a tireless advocate for the greatest and longest suffering of the regime's victims, the Iranian people themselves.
The regime must improve how it treats its citizens. It must protect the human rights of every Iranian. It must cease wasting Iran's wealth abroad. We ask that our international partners continue to add their voice to ours in condemning Iran's treatment of its own citizens.
Secretary Pompeo noted that the protests that have occurred in Iran over the past several months show the people are deeply frustrated with their own government's failures.
The Iranian people, especially its youth, are increasingly eager for economic, political, and social change. The United States stands with those longing for a country of economic opportunity, government transparency, fairness, and greater liberty.
Secretary Pompeo expressed hope that the Iranian regime will come to its senses and support, not suppress, the aspirations of its citizens. He declared that in exchange for the major changes the United States has called for in Tehran's policies, the U.S. is prepared to take actions which help the Iranian people. Now is the time for the Supreme Leader and the Iranian regime to summon the courage to do something historically beneficial for their own people, for this ancient and proud nation. As for the United States, he said, our eyes are clear as to the nature of this regime, but our ears are open to what may be possible. We are looking for outcomes that benefit the Iranian people, not just the regime.